Graham comes from Bloomsterhus, filled with plants and supplies for the spring, like trees, shrubs, and potting soil. Open on Main Street, 10 to 5, Monday through Saturday, and at 907-772-2566.
Ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you a ripe one, don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me up.
Hello, welcome back to another episode of In the Garden. I'm your host, Daniel Rowan Tucker. Well, I couldn't think of much to say about the weather this week. It's been agreeable, but not terribly exciting, I guess. But something exciting, I found another Dawn Redwood tree in Petersburg growing in someone's front yard on Unimac Street. And there's another one over by Hungry Point. And those are the only two I know of in Petersburg. This tree is a living fossil that survived in the wild only in a very small area in a remote valley of China, completely unknown to the outside world until the late 1940s, when it was discovered and seed was distributed. So be very curious to hear more about the provenance and age of those trees in Petersburg. Would be interesting to know if any of them were from the original batches that were distributed around the world in the late 40s and 50s. Today I'm going to dive into a wet, mucky subject that local gardeners are only too well acquainted with, peat. If you live on Mitkoff Island and you like to grow things, there's a good chance that you are gardening in, on, and around peat. What is peat, and what could we do with it? What should we do with it? Many millions of dollars of peat are used in horticulture, but here we usually have a little too much of it, and we need to keep the water moving instead of holding on to it the way peat does. So what is it? Peat is partially decayed organic matter, often but not always, originating from sphagnum mosses. Sphagnum moss grows in places that are damp to begin with, and it makes them even wetter by soaking up water into special cells that make it very spongy, and then also releasing organic acids called tannins that inhibit the processes of decay. So there's a layer of sphagnum that keeps growing at the surface while its previous year's growth and that of any other vegetation around it gets slowly buried in a spongy, saturated mat. And because everything in these lower layers stays effectively underwater and thus in anaerobic conditions. You may be familiar with that if you have a compost pile that got too wet and got all slimy and stinky, and that's similar to what's happening in a peat bog. Things aren't breaking down because there's no oxygen, and so they're kind of pickling. The organic matter doesn't completely break down, and it builds into these deeper and deeper layers over time. In the long run of millions of years of geological time, peat can eventually turn into coal, like lignite coal, kind of a low-grade type of coal, but that takes a really long time. Plant matter and also animals and people can be preserved in peat for thousands of years. Once at the National Museum of Ireland in Dublin, I got to see up close the body of a man who had been buried in a peat bog for over 2,000 years. His skin had turned black and leathery, but every hair on his head was perfectly in place down to the stubble on his chin. It was eerie, to say the least, to be so physically close to someone from so far in the past. Definitely the closest I have ever come to experiencing time travel. The peat of our local muskegs around Petersburg and Papke's Landing has formed over the last few thousand years since the retreat of the ice sheets and glaciers here. In some places, our local peat deposits can be 20 feet thick. I've heard stories of excavators and other heavy equipment being lost in them or very severely trapped in sinking wet peat. And way down beneath all this peat is usually a layer of what's called glaciomarine clay. That's what's locally known as blue clay, interspersed with lots of rocks, boulders, stones of various kinds. And all that clay and rocks was deposited when this area was underwater at the end of the last ice age, because the ice sheets had pushed the land down farther. Effectively, the sea level was higher. The land was lower in relation to the sea. And so the area where Petersburg is now might have been comparable to, say, Leconte Bay, where you have massive quantities of glacial meltwater, milky with fine particles of silt and clay, flowing out of melting glaciers, tidewater glaciers, and all those little fine particles gently settling out in the water column and sinking down to the bottom, forming these thick layers of glacial mud or glacial clay, and then icebergs sometimes carrying larger chunks of rock and boulders floating around as the icebergs melt, dropping boulders and rocks in random places. And that's how this kind of terrain comes to be. And then as it rose out of the sea and became land, the clay made it so that water flows away very slowly. These kind of flat clayish terraces that we have all around Mitkoff Island and many other parts of the Tongass became a perfect place for peat bogs to develop, because the drainage was slow. The sphagnum could get started and then kind of take over. And, you know, for example, if it had been more sandy, we'd have a different ecosystem here. So the peat complicates life here on Mitkoff because it can't be compacted in the same way that inorganic soils like clay and sand can be. So to get a really solid foundation for a building or a road, for it to last a long time, you have to dig out all the peat all the way down to wherever the hard pan is and backfill with crushed rock. And so driving by the hospital and the new hospital buildings and the other developments along Haugen Drive, you can see this really clearly, the excavation of all that peat and then going all the way down to hardpan. Well, large areas of town, the houses were not built in that way. People drove pilings. In some cases, the pilings were yellow cedar. They start to rot out. Even where the pilings are creosote and the pilings themselves last a long time, the house is sitting on pilings. If there's a deck that was, you know, set onto the ground or maybe some gravel on top of the peat, then those things will sink over time, because what happens is that when roads are punched in into the peat and utilities and other things like that, it starts to establish drainage and it changes the whole chemistry of the peat bog, so that some of the water is draining off, the peat isn't all submerged anymore, and it starts to compost effectively. And as it composts, it releases carbon dioxide and it shrinks down gradually. And so people in many parts of town observe this gradual sinking of the land, and, you know, decks start to tilt and lean away from the house, and you can see daylight beneath foundations sometimes, and causes all kinds of building issues. But in those conditions of greater drainage, trees and many more other plants can grow. So you see, you know, like along the bike path along Haugen, all those young pine trees sprouting up. Those are the children of the muskeg pines that were growing along there when that was just a muskeg. All of a sudden you introduce drainage with the road and the bike path and it starts to become a forest. So it's a very dramatic illustration of the differences in those different types of ecosystems and why you need drainage for growing anything other than a peat bog. The vast majority of plants are adapted to thrive in oxygenated soils. They need oxygen in their roots. And in a peat bog, you don't have that. So I came across this really interesting newspaper clipping. July 21st, 1950, this is from the Petersburg Pilot, or whatever it was called at that point, Chamber of Commerce President Earl Omer reported to the chamber at the last meeting on the peat moss situation, and new interest was shown in the promotion of its possibilities. Outside interests have not developed the peat moss here due to the high cost of transportation and processing. Agricultural users are now importing their moss from Canada. Omer mentioned, however, that an Arizona manufacturer has written letters of inquiry about the peat moss, and a government agency tested the local moss and found it of high quality. Besides being used in holding moisture in the soil, the moss is now being pressed and packed with produce to keep it moist during shipping. I thought this was very interesting evidence that even back in the 50s, people were thinking about developing the local peat as a resource. So peat has many uses. Beginning way back in Roman Britain, when the Romans occupied the British Isles, they started digging peat for fuel. It can be dug up with a spade and stacked and dried out in the sun and the wind and then burned like firewood. This has been done for a very long time in places like Scotland, Ireland, Britain, Scandinavia, cold climates with lots of peat. Today, there is mechanized industrial extraction, so big tractors driving back and forth across flat peat bogs with big, wide, high-float tires so they don't sink in, and cutting the peat, and in some cases compacting it into briquettes or other forms so it can then be burned as fuel, sometimes even powering power plants in places like Russia and Scandinavia, Finland. I remember seeing a statistic back in the 40s, I believe, very high proportion of electricity in Russia was being generated by burning peat. And so it's been even a strategic resource in certain times and places. The other big use for peat, of course, is in potting soil. The cellular structure of sphagnum moss is such that, you know, even when it's dead and it's compacted down into these partially decomposed layers, it has this amazingly absorbent quality, that it's so spongy and it holds water and releases it slowly. This makes it really useful in potting soils, for growing plants because you don't have to water them as often. Peat is very, very widely used in all kinds of soils, not just in the nursery trade and your bagged potting soils, but also things that are grown hydroponically, cannabis, tomatoes, you know, all sorts of high-value crops that are grown in greenhouses all over the world. They use vast quantities of peat. And in a potting soil, it does eventually break down because it's aerated. And that organic matter will gradually break down. So there's this kind of continual demand for it from the horticultural industry. And it's very useful in that way. Also in that it has low pH and it's fairly sterile on its own. You know, doesn't introduce, you know, disease issues usually with plants. And all that peat that's being used horticulturally is milled first, so they process it to sort out any of the sticks and rocks and bits and things that, you know, if you've dug around in the local peat here, the raw wild peat, you know, you find all kinds of branches and roots and what have you. So when it's processed for horticulture, all that gets sifted out and it gets ground up into almost a powdery substance, and that's called milling. Other uses for peat, when it's burned, the smoke has a really lovely, can have a really lovely kind of spicy, aromatic scent, and has been used for smoking malt in places like Scotland, the characteristic Scotch malt whiskies like Laphroaig and several others that have this smoky, peaty flavor. can be used for tanning hides. I've read about people burying hides in peat bogs. Apparently Harold Medallin was experimenting with this. I think he had a moose hide or something in a peat bog for several months somewhere in the Muskeg. Would be interesting to hear how that turned out. Certainly you can see the preservative effects on the ancient human bodies that have been found in the bogs. That guy I saw in the Museum of Ireland, he looked like a Gucci handbag, basically, very, very well preserved. And some folk attest to the health benefits of bathing with peat, using it as kind of a poultice, a skin treatment, the astringent qualities of the tannins from the sphagnum moss. And I think my dog's been reading about this, because every time we go on a walk up there on the boardwalk, as soon as we let her off the leash, she just cannonballs into those muskeg holes and comes out looking like a biscotti. She's a golden retriever, so it's like half blonde, half brown. She's a big fan of the therapeutic benefits of bathing in peat water. Apparently, it's good for freshwater aquariums as well. Certain fish really like swimming in water that has peat in it. And peat, as it builds up over time, also forms a really detailed record of the past. You get plant material, pollen, wind-blown dust, sediments, all kinds of things, organic plant materials and other things preserved in this wonderful layer cake going down through the ages. And so it can be very, very, it can be a treasure trove of information for those who study such things. And I'd be very interested to hear if any of those kind of studies have been done on our local muskeg here in Petersburg as to the age of the different layers and, evidence of past ecosystems and past climatic conditions that have been found. Would be very curious to know about that. So the term peat lands can refer to bogs, fens, swamps, mires, moors, muskegs, all kinds of colloquial terms for essentially similar types of environment where peat forms. And these peat lands account for a huge amount of global carbon that's stored in the soil. Some estimates claim that there could be over twice as much carbon sequestered in peatlands as there is in forests worldwide, even though peatlands by surface area only account for something like 3% of land area or terrestrial ecosystems. Because in a peat bog, the carbon builds up and builds up and builds up over time, and it never really gets released unless there happens to be a fire, people dig it up or whatever. Whereas in a typical forest, say even an old growth forest like what you see at the lower end of Raven Trail going up to Raven's Roost, there's a lot of carbon in the trees and the tree trunks, the fallen logs, the roots, things like that. And then the soil, you may have a couple feet of soil with organic matter. But in a living forest, because there's drainage, it's actually releasing CO2 all the time as the logs rot, as the wood rots and things compost in the soil. They give back that CO2 to the atmosphere, and it's constantly cycling. The trees are storing it, but then releasing it after they die. So it's a very different. And so people that are concerned about climate change and looking for ways to hold on to more carbon in the soil are focusing a lot on peatlands. We've got the Global Peatlands Initiative. There's also the International Peatland Society, which is more of kind of a group of scientists and also industry representatives, people that harvest peat on a large scale in Russia, Scandinavia, other places. There's a lot of debates over its use. Peat has been banned in the UK and Ireland recently. New extraction and potting soils using peat have been banned. People are turning to coconut coir, which has similar properties made from fibers of the coconut husk. Lots of debate over that. Lots of really interesting conversations happening. What should we do with our local peat? A lot of it gets dug up when there's large construction projects. And as far as I've been able to find out, it gets hauled out to somewhere borough property back towards the dump, where they have, I think they call it the mud dump, you know, and it all just gets dumped in a heap. Well, you know, it's going to compost there, and release CO2 or whatever anyways. So, I think there's opportunities for finding some local uses for peat. You know, maybe not on the industrial scale of extraction, but could be some small value-added products, you know, health benefits, smoke flavoring would be really interesting to see the specifics on our peat versus other peats in terms of its age and mineral content. But I think there's opportunities, you know, we could upsell our peat-flavored products, peat-smoked fish maybe, peat-smoked whiskey, bourbon, as a local specialty. I think there's all kinds of interesting opportunities. So, yeah, that's a little bit about that squishy brown stuff that we find underfoot all over the place here. And, yeah, next time you go for a walk in the muskeg, take a closer look, you know, think about what peat bogs have been doing all over the world for thousands, millions of years. It's a pretty interesting story. All right, well, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from Blumsterhus, hosting work from over 40 local artists, locally grown flowers, and Scandinavian-inspired gifts. Blumsterhus, on Main Street, Facebook, and at 907-772-2566.